Well, hey everyone, look, I know it's been a while since many of us have been inside an actual record store, so if you're jonesing for some new vinyl, check out AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. None of this VG plus, VG minus, G crap, just the best records you'll find for your final upgrades. Somehow the guys at AudiophileUSA.com find this old store stock, many of these records still sealed for decades, and they make this vinyl available to us. Lots of metal, jazz, classical, and everything in between, and all shipped directly to your front door. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. And we're also brought to you today by Seems Easy Record Jacket Repair Strips. All record collectors and crate diggers have some seam splits somewhere in their collection. Get them fixed from the inside at SeemsEasy.com. Order a baggie of 10, 25, or even 100 at SeemsEasy.com. That's 2 Z's, SeemsEasy.com. Seems easy? Well, that's because it is. And with that, let's get into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning into The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for listening and downloading. And thanks to all you people who are sharing these episodes. And super thanks to everyone who continues to go out to the protest and speak the truths that need to be spoken. Look, I tell you, I'm actually quite hopeful these days. You know, after months, really several years of depressing news story, one after another, the response to the murder of George Floyd is becoming quite inspirational for the change that I believe needs to come. You know, still a long way to go, but feels like there's some momentum building towards a change in the system, which is sorely needed. I think everyone would agree. I truly have had some questions for myself on how I continue with this program in this environment. And I know a lot of my colleagues in the podcast community are pausing their episodes until they're clear on a path forward. And I briefly considered that too, but quite honestly, I feel there are many people out there who see this podcast, The Vinyl Guide, as a connection to others who are like them, and I want to continue that service. I mean, I regularly get emails from people who thank me about the podcast. They tell me stories about how it helps them deal with depression. Depression is a real issue, and it's quite prevalent in the vinyl record collecting community. And to be clear, look, that was never an intended outcome of the show, addressing that and being that connection. But I'm extremely glad it is. I'm proud to be that connection that people see me as, or some people do anyway. Look, overall, I'm clearly on the side of the protesters. I think what happened to George Floyd and others is absolutely atrocious, and change in the community and law enforcement needs to be made. I'm not sure what that looks like, though. That isn't my area of expertise, nor do I ever claim it to be. But overall, I encourage everyone to speak up about the wrongs of society and do what they can do to make it a better place. And I believe this show is part of my contribution to those who enjoy it and take comfort and connection from it. So overall, be well, be respectful for others, be safe and supportive for those who need it. And I'll be here talking about records and other nerdery that is so important to many of the listeners. So there's my thoughts, and thank you all for listening to them. So this week on The Vinyl Guide, we are speaking to alarm guitarist and YouTube shredding sensation John Sanders, also known by the alias Doug Steele, Shred Durst, and possibly a few other names. But I know him as my longtime friend, John Sanders, a guy I grew up with. I probably have consumed several thousand beers with him by now. And coincidentally, we both moved from California to Australia, although he's in Melbourne, I'm in Sydney. And John truly is one of my best friends and one hell of a talented musician. And aside from his guitar skills that you may have seen on YouTube, John is a huge contributor to this show. You may recognize him as the guy that says this.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Yep, that voice is John Sanders of the band Alarum, who has a new LP, Circle's End. It's available this week with a super limited vinyl run of just 300. 150 standard vinyl pressing and 150 deluxe. And that is the first pressing, so get yours immediately at alarum.com. They're going to go quick. They will be collectible, and that's what we love. The new Alarum album, Circle's End, is getting fantastic reviews. I've been listening to it come together literally for years, but most recently the final versions that Neil Kernan produced and mixed down. I mean, sonically, it is absolutely killer. So jump on a vinyl copy at alarum.com. Now today, John and I discuss his guitar beginnings, his previous band, Sinister Sam and Flatstick, then him joining Alarum, touring, and more. He also talks about his Doug Steele persona, the YouTube channel where he breaks down the various Van Halen solos and more. I think you'll enjoy this one. I know I certainly did. And if you enjoyed today's conversation with John Sanders, we've got a heap of other interviews and episodes with some amazing metal musicians as well, including episode 216 of The Vinyl Guide featuring Paige Hamilton of Helmet, breaking down his approach to songwriting and the rare vinyl of the band. That's Paige Hamilton of Helmet, episode 216 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 214 features Chuck Billy of Testament, talking about getting over COVID-19, rare vinyl, and the new album. Episode 205 features Derek Green, lead singer of Sepultura. Episode 188, Talkin' Van Halen with Greg Renoff. Episode 183, with the Atomic Clock himself, Gene Hoagland. Episode 128, with Miles Kennedy. Episode 116, with Mike Portnoy. Episode 114, with Zakk Wylde, and heaps more. All episodes are available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get these podcasts. And look, if you have an Android device, check out the podcast app Sonnet. It's an elegant, bullshit-free Android podcast app. Sonnet is made by podcast lovers and has a great user design and interface with a simplicity that an Android podcast world desperately needs. Go wherever you get your Android apps and get Sonnet now. And with that, let's start today's conversation with John Sanders of Alarum. This week on The Vinyl Guide, John Sanders of the band Alarum, Flatstick, Sinister Sam, it goes back a ways, God. And hi John Boy, how are you?
I'm doing good, Poppy, how are you?
I'm doing good. This is probably a good time to introduce the fact that you and I grew up together.
We did. We met when I was, 20? We were about, 24?
Mm-hmm. Early 20s, something like that. We had... a couple of girlfriends.
Yeah.
But they put us on a play date together. And we eventually dumped the girls, but we continued to hang out. So,
yeah. That was fun. So they were very smart in doing that.
Very instrumental. Do you even remember their names? I don't.
I remember Bobby, I won't say your last name. Bobby was my girlfriend, and I do not remember what your girlfriend's name was.
I don't either. And I guess that's oh, well. I got John out of the deal, so I think I came out pretty good.
Massive win on your part.
And so not only did we grow up together in San Jose, but then within a few years of one another, we both moved to Australia, although you were in Melbourne, I'm in Sydney. I haven't had anyone on the show yet there where I actually had that sort of lineage and have been a participant in their wedding. So
yeah. It's awesome, and because we've also been back to the States at the same time as well. So remember we went and saw Borat, all of us?
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's weird. It's good. So anyway, so ladies and gentlemen, this is really, you know, one of my best friends in the world, John Sanders. And hello. I'm so happy that you've now got some new music out, because I've always been, and you know, I've always been a big fan of you, John, because even in San Jose, you were doing Sinister Sam. I was always just so proud that my friend was doing something that I thought was so cool. And unfortunately, Sinister Sam disintegrated, but you've now got this new band, Alarum, in Melbourne, and the new album, Sphere of Influence. I'm really enjoying it. It really is good.
No, dude, the name of the album is Circle's End.
What? It circles
in. The name of the album is Circle's End. Sphere of Influence was our first single.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. I learned something today.
You learn something new every day.
Circle's End. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
New album, Circle's End. All right. There we go. But look, I've been listening to the new album, whatever it's called, and I really do enjoy it because to me, it's got it's heavy, but it's also got that really cool, mellow, kind of bossa nova type feel throughout. And, you know, there's a lot of different styles. So, and it's something that I've always associated with you, very eclectic and a lot of different influences. It's not just metal. It's all over the musical biosphere.
First off, thank you. Secondly, you know, me, Palf, and Scotty, we all three write, so there's just there's never a lack of ideas. It's always paring back and scaling back, but, you know, obviously we want to write stuff that's enjoyable for us as well as the listener, and, you know, we want to be able to do this stuff live and just absolutely kill it.
Okay, so, and the music is very complex. There's a lot of pieces, as you said. How does the writing in Alarum occur? Is it just, you know, everyone throwing in ideas? Does someone start with kind of a backbone and everyone builds on it? How does it work?
Well, for this particular album, Scott actually had ideas from Eventuality, which was the last album that they did. I wasn't in the band at this stage, though. And he just brought those forward, and those were complete songs, I think two of them. And then there were other songs that Palf wrote that were complete. Some of them weren't, and we worked on them together. And I wrote an intro and a full song, so my stamp is on there as well. So, but usually how we write is we do it, we just go to Palf's house, and we just sit there. We got Pro Tools there, and we just come up with ideas, and if we like the ideas, they move forward. Very rarely does an idea get knocked back, which is cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So it's just, it's a really open vibe to create something, you know, as cool or as wild or as nice as you want.
Now, the last Alarum album was, I want to say 8-9 years ago, something like that. Yeah. Why does it take so long to make an Alarum album?
It takes long because there's either tours or there's live gigs happening. We all three have full-time jobs, and it's hard sometimes to get us all together in the one room. Just stuff like that, really.
But once you guys get in a room, it sounds like there's that, you know, collaboration where you guys are throwing out ideas and recording stuff right there. What's the fastest a song has come together from this album?
Oh, I'm going to say 3 days, you know, because we hook up every Sunday. So, yeah, I'm going to say roughly 3 days.
Okay.
Like, actually, Sphere of Influence was written pretty quickly. Palf had the majority of it. I kind of helped with the tail end, and then, you know, Scott put his stamp on it as well. So it is a 2-minute and 20-second song. But it was written relatively quickly.
Okay.
Actually, not only that, Crystals and Sand was written pretty quickly as well. That was the one I did. I wrote all the parts for everybody. So yeah, relatively quick, although it seems like it's a pretty intricate song.
Now, when I listened to Sand, I could have sworn it has your fingerprints all over it. It sounds very Alan Holdsworth-ish.
Well, it's the only, Crystals and Sand are the only tracks with keyboards. So I don't know. I think live we might try it without and see how sparse it sounds. Because, you know, a lot of bands now are playing with backing tracks and stuff, and I'm kind of don't like being locked into a time-stamped type of thing. So we're going to try it without live whenever that happens, and we'll see how we go. But yeah, you know, I like Devin Townsend. I like Meshuggah. I like the band Textures, and I just wanted to kind of make something big, I guess. Mm.
You mentioned playing live. Can all these songs be pulled off live?
Yeah. You went to a gig when we were supporting Obscura up in Sydney, yeah. And we played, I think, maybe three or four of them live.
Okay. So we're going to be seeing some more Alarum live once this COVID thing is over, but yeah.
Yeah, dude, we had all of our, you know, album launch gigs booked. We were ready to rock. We had the bands. We were going to ping pong between headlining and supporting, and then COVID hit, and then nothing. So, you know, what are you going to do? Everything went to a halt at that stage.
Oh, everyone around the world. But what's interesting is now Australia, we're starting to kind of relax a bit with it. But I think it's going to be a long time before you start to see a lot of bands travel to Australia. So I think over the next year or so, Australian bands touring Australia is going to be quite big. People are hungry for entertainment. They want to go out. They want to see some bands. You guys are here. There's no need to do the 14-day quarantine or anything. This is the time to shine.
Yeah, I'm worried about, I personally am just worried about like plane ticket prices. I mean, we can drive to, you know, to Adelaide, and we're a Melbourne band, so we can, you know, play those shows and go up to Sydney and maybe even Canberra. Queensland would be a bit rough, but I mean, we're open to everything as long as it's kind of realistic.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
But yeah, dude, I mean, obviously we're one of these bands, just like every other band, that wants to play absolutely everywhere we can.
Well, good. I hope you get your chance this year. I think you could well have that opportunity. Now, the new album, Circle's End, available on streaming services. You're doing CDs. You also have a very limited run of vinyl, from what I understand.
Yeah, we've got Gatefold, and I guess what would the other one be called? Normal?
Oh, okay.
Like Gatefold, I think, is the special one, and then the normal album is just the normal. I don't know what that's called.
Okay.
I don't even think I know what Gatefold means either.
So it's the Gatefold's the fold-out one. Is it two records, three records? What's it? What's the configuration of it?
I think it's five per side because it's a 10-track album, so I'm tipping that's what it is.
All right.
It's cool because I don't want to give anything away, but when you open up the gatefold, it's a nice collage of like working on the album and that kind of stuff. And it's the artwork, which was done by our drummer's brother, John Hawking. It's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. It's lovely to look at. It's not like your typical black with the black metal font vibe. It's a lot lighter than that. And so the artwork 100% complements the music, and we're proud as punch.
And also involved in this album was Neil Kernan. Can you describe his contribution to Circle's End?
Yeah, he mixed the whole thing, which was really interesting because I think he was living in Chicago at the time. So all the input back and forth was done via email. So we'd have to listen to things, make notes, send them back. He'd have to tweak. Email us back with the new, what he had done, the revisions, and then we'd, you know, say yay or nay. Sometimes it took a while, sometimes it didn't, but he's made the album. It's so incredibly ballsy. Like, those kick drums are just in your face. Mm-hmm. And the dude, I mean, he's worked with, you know, I got to talk to him about, he's mixed Queensryche, Rage for Order, Dokken, and Under Lock and Key. He worked with Hall & Oates. I think he was Ringo Starr's first in-house engineer when Ringo had his home studio kind of thing. Mm. So the dude, his resume is crazy. If you go on Wikipedia, dude, it's a mishmash of everything. And for him to like heavy music, I think that's awesome that we have people with that kind of experience to be able to, you know, understand, you know, to put the balls into something.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. He's got an incredible resume. It's not just in one genre. It's all over the place.
He's a badass.
He's got Cannibal Corpse and Exhumed on the same list as Peter Gabriel and Kansas.
Like, his ears would be amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And it was all done remote. How did he get involved in the project?
I think he was, from what I recall, he's an Alarum fan. So our bass player, Palf, who kind of runs everything, got in touch with him. And yeah, that was basically it. He's going to mix the album, and that's exactly what he did.
Now, did you guys leave anything off of the record? Did you over-record and then pare it down to the songs that you, the 10 songs that you have there?
I think there were one or two songs that didn't make it. It's not that they didn't make the cut. They'll actually probably be on the next album. So, yeah, look, I'm not a big fan of like writing 15 songs and then, you know, only using 12. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of the other guys are either. But no, it didn't really come to that. I just think that whatever didn't make it on this album will make it on the next album. And that could be one or two songs.
Okay. Yeah. And what's your favorite song off the new album?
Probably the title track, Circle's End, which starts with, you know, a nice clean thing by Scott. He's a really good guitar player and a really good songwriter. The dude, he's got it all. And this is one of his babies, and it's very epic. It's on the longer side, and it's ballsy and clean at the same time.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you guys have a mutual respect for one another. Like, your favorite song is not necessarily the one that you created. It's from the band, and even you're not even the main contributor into it, but respecting his vision is... That's nice.
Yeah, like, I think his favorite's one of mine, my favorite's one of his. We all love the PALF stuff. Yeah. From like track 4 to track 9, they all kind of flow together, and that's where... So it's like the first two or three songs kind of get you warmed up. It's definitely like a journey, you know? You got to listen to the whole album, but it is a journey. But yeah, from like track 4 to about track 9, it gets kind of wacky in a good way.
You joined Alarum about 5 years ago, is that right?
No, I think I've been in the band for 8 years.
How did it come to where you were joining the band?
The original guitar player left, and the drummer who I was friends with asked me to join, and... I said yes, and then I heard the music, and then I flipped out and was like, I don't think I can play this stuff, and because it was so difficult, and they gave me tabs, and I just wanted to learn it by ear, and that just wasn't going to happen. So it took me, with tab, maybe 2 weeks per song to kind of get it down. Mm. Yeah, dude, it was extremely challenging, to say the least. And then, you know, after that, we toured the Natural Causes album, and we actually went on tour to Europe, which I'd never been to before. So it was like, I'm going to Europe, and I'm going on tour. So it was two firsts for me. It was great, great fun.
Did you find when you got together with the Alarum guys, like, you guys had the same influences, or were there many differences between those?
No. There's a lot of them that where we cross over, and we all like Death. Scotty likes Cynic, and as do I, and PALF. But I think that's kind of his band. I'm into more like the Anthrax, Meshuggah vibe, and now Ginger. And PALF likes old school stuff, old school thrash, as well as newer stuff as well. So, those two are massive fans of Atheist out in Florida, and they turned me on to Atheist, and now I love Atheist. So we just get together, like, before we start recording stuff, PALF will throw on an album, or we'll get on YouTube and we'll just start listening to other bands, and we love music and all kinds. Mm.
So going back to your youth, your beginnings, what's your first musical memory?
I was 5 years old. My oldest sister, who was about 20 or 21, she gave me Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Brain Salad Surgery on vinyl. Yeah. And I don't know what it was, but I absolutely loved it. And, you know, there was a lyric sheet, and I got to read that. Not only that, but like my family, we always had a jukebox in the house.
Like a literal jukebox.
So I'd wake up in the morning, run over to the heater, turn on the jukebox, listen to Black Dog by Led Zeppelin. That was like my wake-up morning song. But, you know, I had three older sisters, two of which I think were stoners. So there was Creedence, there was Elvis, there was The Doors. Mm-hmm. I was surrounded by music. My mother played piano by ear. My aunt played guitar. So did our grandfather. So it was just like a very... But on the other side, like, my dad can't even count to 4. So that's where we're at.
Okay. So music in your household, it was a bit of a currency. Music was important. You saw how it was important to others, and you made it important to you.
Yeah, like music for me, like what Zappa says, music is the best. It 100% is. I don't have to watch TV, although I do. Sports doesn't really come into my life. None of that stuff. But music, you know, if I'm not listening to it, I'm talking about it. I'm online looking at guitar gear, which my wife hates. So, you know, or recording gear or whatever, you know. So, yeah, I am 100% enveloped by music.
Hmm. And what made you cross over from listener to participant?
For a while I wanted to be Keith Emerson. I was one of these dudes, like I'd try something and then within a couple weeks I'd quit. So I had drum lessons, quit those. Had guitar lessons, quit those. Got into baseball. Actually, that stuck for a while. But when I was about 15, my mom's boyfriend gave me a guitar. It was like a Gaia tone. It was really, really horrible. But it was then, you know, that I was checking out Kiss and listening to Ace Frehley and like, I love the guitar. I want to be a lead guitar player. As a 10-year-old, I bought a shirt and had them put in these like black velvet letters, lead guitar. I can't play it, but I just want everybody to know that I am one. Ridiculous. And then when I was able to actually purchase my own guitar, I bought a Tokai Strat that's like a dime slime green color. Mm-hmm. And it had a humbuckers near the bridge, and that was it. It was a single pickup guitar. And I sold it when I got out to Australia. I sold it, but I actually bought it back and I have it now. So, but that was my very first guitar. And when I bought it at Guitar Center in Bascom Avenue for like $281 or something.
And it's made its way back to you in Australia.
Yeah. Like the dude, like there have been a couple times when I've called him and I'm like, yeah, I'm ready to buy it back. And he would like double the price. And I was like, dude, don't be a dick. And then finally he messaged me, you know, about 2 years ago. And he goes, look, you name the price and I'll just resell it back to you. So I did. And I undercut him.
So that's okay. So he was the second owner and it's back with you.
I'm back with
you. And what's interesting is when I see you do these videos on YouTube, you use that guitar pretty regularly. So it must have been something that, you know, kind of fits your hand like a glove. You're playing the style that you have in your playing fits with that guitar.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't play it as much as I should. I don't know. The neck was handmade for me, and it's actually not fun to play. But I also use my wife's $15 Samick Strat quite a bit as well, because there's no Floyd Rose. The tuning, you can, you know, switch tuning pretty quickly, that kind of a vibe. And I'm going to give out my YouTube channel right now. It's Doug Steele Guitarist. Just type in Doug Steele, and that should be the first thing that pops up.
And let's talk about Doug Steele, because your name, you go by two monikers, and I'm not even sure what, are you John Sanders or Doug Steele on the Alarm album?
I'm John Sanders. I want to make that kind of like legit. Mm-hmm. The Doug Steele thing came about because I was doing radio at a little, you know, a little community station out here, and I was pretty much ripping off Howard Stern, so I just wanted to use somebody else's name. The plan was to use somebody else's name once a month and then change the name. So Doug Steele was somebody that I actually worked with at the Melbourne airport, and he made me mad. So I'm like, I want this guy to, you know, I want hate focused on him, not John Sanders. So I'm going to use his name. And then somebody messaged me while I was working at the community station. They're like, hey, Triple M, which is a massive commercial station. They're like, they're auditioning people. So I just sent in the most disgusting tape I had of myself with the name Doug Steele, and they called me, and yeah, I was on air for like, I don't know, 5 years, and I worked with Kyle and Jackie O and did some late night stuff as well. It was, you know, pretty funny. And then when I left, I got you a gig doing some tidbits for what?
Ugly Phil.
I forget the name of the show.
I remember it was Ugly Phil's.
You did Ugly, yeah, and yeah. So yeah, two Americans kicking ass in radio.
That was before the website Fiverr. They needed an American voice to be able to go through like the top 10 or whatever like that.
Planet Rock.
You know, they had you for a while, then they went to me on your recommendation, and now it's like you could pay any American on the other side of the world, and they'll just send you a WAV file, and it's fine. But no one listens to radio anyway. It's just such a Dead medium. God.
Oh, good times. Just a thing. You must have been hanging out with me.
I almost,
when I was doing radio.
I almost made my career in radio. How depressing would that have been?
That's a whole nother podcast. Mm-hmm.
One of these days we'll get to do one in this while we're in the same room and just go through a whole bunch of stories because there are a ton.
Yeah.
I remember when you were living at my house in Sydney. After you got the gig at the radio station and you were having back problems. And
oh my
you
God.
Stayed at the house, like you lived in our living room on this massage table for about, I want to say 2 months. Does that sound right?
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is when I was first dating Mary. And I remember that we'd come into the house and you'd be right there in front of the television on this massage table. You really didn't move much for 2 months. And we would just have these great conversations. And I remember the fact that she got along with you made me think that, okay, this is, she's, we could make this work between her and I, because
that's awesome.
I've had a lot of girlfriends in my life that have not gotten along with you.
Yeah, the dumb ones.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, look, if you don't get along with John, then you're kind of not into the sort of humor and the sort of kind of viewpoint that I have. So yeah, it's not promising for the long term.
Litmus test. Yeah.
Yeah. So your first live show, I believe you told me, was Elvis Presley. Is that right?
Yeah. My grandmother took me when I was about 6 years of age. Fresno Celandino, where all the Van Halen, you know, shows that are, you know, all over YouTube in 78 and 79 or whatever. But yeah, apparently it was a great sounding place. And I saw Elvis there. I was way up in the nosebleeds and I was kicking the seat in front of me. That was my jam.
Do you remember, like, you know, a little white guy with cape dancing around? Do you remember any of that?
Yeah, he was a huge. He took up like 3/4 of the stage, this guy. And the thing I remember, I don't remember the songs so much, but I remember that he had continual towels around his neck and the women screaming in the audience were as loud as the band. And that I thought was mesmerizing. And he'd throw out a towel and it'd go, and the screaming and the fighting, it was insane. And I still liked kicking the seat in front of me more than watching the show. I never said I was smart.
Well, you're a kid. I mean, look, well, you can't expect a kid to really pay full attention to Elvis necessarily. But that must have made a deep mark on you as well, just people's reaction to Elvis. Same way that, you know, your family's reaction to Emerson, Lake and Palmer or Black Dog made an impression on you. Their reaction to Elvis must have also been equal, if not greater, at that point.
I'm going to say that the Elvis thing would have, anything, geared my thinking toward the live show, as well as like all the Frank Zappa footage. Like I'm so upset that I never got to see Frank live. You know, but my brother-in-law did, and he was at those really early shows as well. So I get to pick his brain about that every now and then. But as far as live shows go, I think Frank, for me, would be at the top of the list with the dance contests and things like that. Just, dude, come on. You can't really top that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big regret of mine, too, never seeing. I actually remember having the opportunity to see Zappa, but he wasn't in concert. He was doing a talk, I think at like De Anza College on electronic music.
Whoa.
And I remember thinking like, oh, I kind of want to see him live. I'm not sure I want to see him talk about the synclavier, which right now I'm like, fuck, I should have. Like, whoa.
Yeah, there was a bill, Mr. Bungle, Dream Theater, and the Deli Creeps playing in Oakland. And I passed that up. I'm like, yeah, they'll be around again. And yeah, and it's one of those ones where I'm kicking myself in the nuts every day that I skipped out on.
Well, there was that one New Year's show in San Francisco. I want to say it's Mr. Bungle, Primus, and Tool opened.
Yeah, I missed that one too. And I was asked to go, and I wanted to stay home with my girlfriend.
Do you remember her name?
And she went to bed. Dude, yeah, Bobby. It was the same girlfriend. It was Bobby. And she went to bed. So I think I was drunk in the living room watching like MTV or something, going, I really, really made a mistake here.
Oh, well, you had fun with her while it lasted.
I did.
You got me through it. So Sinister Sam was your band in San Jose, and I loved going to see Sinister Sam playing at Cactus and various other locations around the Bay Area. Talk me through Sinister Sam. Like, how did you form? How did it come together? And why did it fall apart?
Okay, Sinister Sam was actually a note I had passed. My friend Scott Miller is the other guitar player in Sam, and we had classes together in high school at Silver Creek High School in San Jose, Eastside San Jose, and I passed him a note saying, hey, I'm this cool dude headlining at Chuck E. Cheese. I'm in a band called Sinister Sam, yada, yada, yada. So he took that band name and he did like an ice cream social at the high school and named the trio Sinister Sam. So it was like a high school thing. And then, you know, kind of after high school, like, let's make this a legit thing. And, you know, we went through some members and then we started playing shows. We released two demos and we were supporting, you know, international acts at the Cactus Club, you know, not too long after our first demo, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was because of, you know, we had John the Machine Perrine on drums, who was, he was about 10 years older than us, but he's a freak on drums. Mm-hmm. So he brought his little people to the group, and you know, we all had our friends, and it was just like I don't know, like Mr. Bungle meets Pantera with shred guitar, and you know, everybody's wearing, you know, cheerleading outfits or something.
The live shows were amazing. I remember, and everyone was different. It was like a party, almost like a circus going to see Sinister.
Yeah. My favorite shows were the ones where we would blow up the beach balls and have beach ball fights with the audience, because we'd kick the balls, and they, you know, the stage was at a little, I guess it was at waist height, but when you kick a ball straight ahead, you're going to clobber somebody in the face. And it ain't gonna hurt, but it's going to make you laugh. So, you know, you're kicking, you're trying not to laugh, you're moving around. It was so much fun. And then obviously we got told by management, don't bring the balls, because they were, you know, hitting the lights. Yeah. And there's, you know, 5 minimum or even 10. And we just, you know, yeah, loved it. Loved it.
And you guys are opening them for Deftones. Did you guys open up for Bungle?
No. We opened up, I think, for Merv. I wish I had the list on me, but Merv, maybe even the Diesel Queens, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. But yeah, just a lot of either funk or Psychofunkapus was another band that we opened for. Forbidden and Violence we opened for. Yeah, it was kind of mixed. I think we wanted to always open for Fishbone because they're just the greatest. And, you know, obviously Primus and all the big ones. Mm-hmm. But we did okay.
And then at some point it started imploding. Do you remember a moment what you thought?
John, John Perrine, I think he got sick of it. And then who was the drummer? And then what else happened? And then, you know, a couple of the Sam guys started helping out another band that we were into called Disorderly Conduct. So it kind of got split. And, you know, me and the other and the singer for Sinister Sam, we weren't cool with, like, we thought it was whoring yourselves out or whatever. But we, you know, I was pretty set on making Sam the only thing that I did. Mm-hmm. And to see other dudes do other things kind of didn't make me feel great. And then I met a girl from Australia, and then that whole thing happened. And then, you know,
and
you were there for that.
Yeah, but so actually you guys had Glenn Sobel on drums for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, and that was all because we recorded the demos at Prairie Sun Studios. You know, we were able to meet some, you know, top-notch dudes because, you know, that's where everybody on the Shrapnel label recorded, mm-hmm. So... I think our singer, Gary, at the time, he went up to some clinic and Glenn was there and he popped Glenn a tape. And Glenn's like, yeah, I like this stuff. I'll do it. And we were like, what? And like, dude, the rehearsals, we only had like 2 rehearsals with Glenn before we did shows. Mm-hmm. But like, dude, he smashed it out of the goddamn ballpark. It was crazy how good he was. Yeah. And we loved it. And there was actually a show that we did where you were on keyboards but playing samples.
Right.
So you were on stage with Glenn Sobel from Alice Cooper.
I do remember that show. I missed a lot of my cues.
That's totally fine. But the funny thing is like when we were doing sound check and Wedge was like, okay, Nate, do your keyboards. And it was just like machine gun fire and people screaming.
that's,
Yeah, that was the best, dude.
Yeah. And I remember Glenn drove all the way from L.A. for each show. And
No, kind of. But yeah, he learned the set list in the car while he was driving.
He listened to the demo in the car. And I remember two or three shows, I believe, he played. And each time he drove up from L.A., and that was a 6 or 7 hour drive. And I remember thinking, fuck, this guy's really dedicated to just playing this one gig. He's loading up his car with drums. He's driving up here and then driving all the way back. You know, he's not even making enough at the gig to pay for the gas, right?
Totally.
To me, that was around the time of my life where I was meeting these musicians. When I was working at Apple, I started meeting people who would, they were so much more dedicated to their craft than anyone I'd met. They'd set their clock 2 hours early, so they wake up at 5 and get 2 hours of guitar practice in before they came to work. You know, I never thought about doing that sort of thing, and that's when I started realizing, you know what, this was not something I'm dedicated to the level of really, you know, doing anything. I remember it's like, this is not for me. I'm not on the same page as these guys.
Yeah, yeah. I did at one stage, but now that I'm, you know, 51, I've kind of given myself a little bit of a break.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Glenn's amazing, and not only that, but we're still friends now. So every time that Alice Cooper comes to town, we hang out. Mm-hmm. It's good fun.
Yeah. Oh, he's a good guy. Fuck, he's a great musician.
I love Glenn.
Now, when you came out to Australia, you formed your own project, which is Flatstick. Talk to me about that.
I was working in a music store, found out that one of the other guitar teachers had recording gear. No, actually, this bass player that was teaching there as well. And he says, you guys would probably get along. Let's hook you two up. And so, yeah, he hooked us up and then went over to Gary's house. We recorded one song together, which ended up being a song on the Flatstick album called Bend Over. And that was the very first song we'd recorded. And it was like a two-man project. And we sold the CDs out of the music store we worked at, which was Main Street Music in Greensboro. And we were like number one on mp3.com for like the best metal song. And that would have been Adios.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a fun project. A lot of drinking was involved. Everything was done by me and Gary. We both programmed the drums. And it was just one of those things where the songs really did kind of write themselves. It was one of the easier things I've ever had to work on in my life.
I tend to think that when I look back at your projects, that seems to be a real happy point in your life, because it seemed to be the music was flowing. You were really energized by it. Not that you're not for Alarm, but I just remember seeing you with Flatstick, and after seeing you with Sinister Sam, and just noticing like how well that routine seemed to work for you.
Yeah. I think our album was 9 songs. It did take a while, because sometimes Gary had to take on paid work to keep, you know, because it was just, he just had a bedroom in his house, you know, that he converted into a studio, and he just recently had gotten Pro Tools in. But, you know, it was fun. We had a blast making it. We were working on the second album, which was so close to being done. The Black Saturday fires hit, and Gary passed away from cancer, which was the worst thing ever. That was such a horrible time for his friends, my friends, like the all the teachers at Main Street Music. It was just so incredibly sad. And I think about Gary all the time, because he was a great guitar player. He was a great friend. He was fun. He was a little bit older than me. And his stories were absolutely, he had the best stories, and they were just hilarious. He was a lovely guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if people want to hear Flatstick, you can go to flatstick.bandcamp.com. The album Omnicore is a collection of those songs. I think there's another collection as well after that of the stuff that you were working on. But Omnicore album and Sinister Sam, Picklehead Willie, I still go back to those recordings pretty frequently, because they really, they're funny, they're diverse, and I don't know, they just bring back so many good memories for me. So, Yeah, I'll put links to those recordings in this episode page. So you're here at Alarum, the new album Circle's End. You're also doing a lot of YouTube videos. You have broken down just about every Van Halen song, track, solo for the first 4 to 6 albums. You're not into... Have you broken down much Van Halen beyond 5150?
No. Like, everybody knows when they go onto my YouTube page that it's more or less the first 4 Van Halen albums, and that's it. I'm done. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And...
Like, and you know, and I, you know, I love that, like... I love Women and Children for, I love the first 4 a lot. So, and I don't want to, like, Diver Down has got too many covers on it, but you know, Hang 'Em High is a great song. Secrets is a great song. But as I was going more heavy, Eddie to me was going more light. So, and then when I heard Jump, I was elated that there was a new Van Halen album out, but you know, his guitar tone changed. He had a lot of chorus on those riffs. And I just started to kind of, you know, get out of it a bit and go with heavier bands, as you do when you're in high school. Mm-hmm.
Pretty much your YouTube channel is breaking down. And it's not just Eddie Van Halen, but it started probably the core, the foundation is those first 4 Van Halen albums and just breaking down each solo and track and everything, you know,
for
people who want to learn how to play it themselves. And that's great. And now you're also branching out to George Lynch and a few others. What other guitarists are you fascinated by and putting on your YouTube page?
The ones that I'm fascinated by are the ones that I can brought up, you know, we're probably high school dudes like Warren DeMartini and that kind of, that I can kind of do a little bit. If it requires me to go back and actually learn something, I'm not into it. I want to pump out all the stuff I know right now. And then when it gets, cause look, I work a full-time job. I'm in a band. Like, time is scarce around here. So, if it's easy and I know it already, like there's some Montrose stuff I want to break down off the Gamma albums. I'd like to do that. I'd like to work on some other Van Halen. What I'm really focusing on now is somebody wants me to do the whole Live Without a Net solo, and which I'm cool to do, but I'm going to have to do it in chunks because it's such a long solo. I'm not going to have like this hour-long thing explaining each lick, so it'll just have to be like a playlist of like 20 different clips.
Right. I know in the Van Halen community, people look at your YouTube channel as, you know, the preeminent, the high watermark. If you want to learn Eddie's secrets, go to the Doug Steele YouTube channel, and you break it down.
Yeah.
And it's also very, very humorous. It's very, you know, it's not like some stodgy guitar teacher that is a drag to watch. I mean, even my kids, they don't even play guitar, and they'll watch one of your YouTube videos and they'll be laughing just because the way you present it is so approachable and fun. And so everyone, I know Greg and Josh, all those guys are always kind of pointing toward your YouTube channel as the one to check out. So again, I'll put that link in this episode page.
Thank you.
Watch the Doug Steele breakdown of a lot of these Van Halen riffs and other guitarists as well. All right, so John Boy, anything else we want to talk about, especially Alarum, non-Alarum, anything?
I just want to give out the Alarum website. So if you want to buy, like, we're going to have merch, we're going to have CDs, the album, it's all going to be there at alarum.com, alarum.com. I can't think of anything. Ibanez, I want an endorsement from you. A grade, I want the Doug Steele model guitar, which is going to be a 7-string. Who else? Line 6, who I've worked with in the past. I want an A-grade endorsement, please. Thank you very much. Dickies, the clothes. I want an endorsement from you guys as well.
Good. We'll line them up. Anyone else?
Let me redo your intro. You need something fresh.
Yeah, actually, this is probably I was wondering if you remember how to do what the intro is to the show?
do you like vinyl records? Something like that. I don't know.
Well,
I like the guy. I like the guy you had that did it before me, and he's all snarky and whatever. Oh, well, here you go, yeah. Or whatever he said.
The first, yeah. I think, the first half dozen episodes of the Vinyl Guide, I went on Fiverr because I wanted to pop out this podcast really quick, and I just got some guy. I literally paid him $15. Just do these intros, and he just sounded like such a turd. If you go to, yeah, if listeners want to hear what I'm talking about, yeah, episodes 1 through 5, I think, of the Vinyl Guide, those intros. And then John said, just let me do those. So John Boy, thank you so much for coming on the show. Look, I love you. I really do.
I love you too. I love you too. We've had the greatest times together. Mm-hmm.
And they're not over yet.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping
to get
back down to Melbourne. I was always hoping we would do this interview face-to-face, but, you know, it is what it is, right? But
hey, when you come down to Melbourne, we'll do a live stream on my channel and whatever.
Sure.
You promote it on yours. Yeah, it'll be good.
That's fine. I'm happy to do it. But again, look, I'm also very proud of this album. I've been listening to Circle's End for the past several days since I got it from your PR guy, and it really is quite good. I remember hearing bits and pieces of it as you guys were working on it and thinking it was really interesting, and now it's all come together. The Neil Kernan touches on it, and it really is something special, and I hope you guys are proud of it. You guys have put a hell of a lot of work into it, and I hope everyone gets a chance to take a listen to it, because it is really a great album. I'm going to put some links on this episode page where people can order the vinyl. From what I understand, there's an extremely limited pressing. I think there's two different pressings, 150 of each one, and then it's gone,
yeah,
at least for this early one. So get in early. I know it's going to be special. There's the gatefold. There's the other version. Those will be orderable at alarum.com. Again, John Boy, thank you so much, and I hope to see you soon.
I love you.
Love you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Right, there he is, Mr. John Sanders of Alarum. Go to alarum.com and get yourself a vinyl copy of their new release. Only 300 made, so get it done pretty quick. You can also go on any streaming service later this week and get the new Alarum album, Circle's End. Check it out. Try before you buy, but don't sleep on it, because those records will go quick. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for listening. And if you like what we do here, then please consider becoming a patron of The Vinyl Guide. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/vinylguide. And up there, you pledge a couple of bucks a month and you get access to early episodes, secret episodes, extra junk, extended interviews, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And I also understand that there's lots of folks out there where patronage is not an option at this point, and I totally appreciate that. If you have an opportunity, just please share these episodes with your friends and write us a nice review on Apple, iTunes, or podcast, or whatever it is. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10. Do us a solid favor like that, and that is so much appreciated. And there it is. I hope you're all well. Be good, be safe, and we'll be back with a brand new episode shortly. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.
Thanks, John Boy.